Okay.
So our daf here on Daf Gimel brings us into a fascinating question that we know that we deal with mitzvos on different levels. That we have mitzvos min haTorah and we have mitzvos min haDavar. And the two interact. And how exactly they interact is an important question. And the reason it comes up immediately for us here, even though there are many different examples, is because we find the suggestion in the Rishonim on Daf Gimel that there could be a surprising impact of a Din D'Rabbanan on the Mitzvah D'Oraisa. So what am I talking about? What gets introduced over here on Daf Gimel? Let's say you have a mitzvah like sukkah. Right? And the sukkah could be valid on the level of min haTorah. But the rabbis, don't take it personally. The rabbis, you're invited to put your stuff here. It's a place of covered. So the rabbis, let's say they edit or revise a mitzvah, for lack of a better term. So as far as Torah law is concerned, the mitzvah would have been accepted. But the rabbis added to it. Now they could add to it a number of ways, which is something that we'll have to discuss. But whatever it is, right now the mitzvah takes a different form because of the Din D'Rabbanan. So what happens if one were to say, I'm a Torah Jew, I don't believe in the rabbinical laws, I just follow the Torah, and I maybe didn't satisfy everything that the rabbi said, but I am doing what the Torah says. What does God think of that? Does God say to you, okay, at least you got that? Or does he say, no, sorry, God says, sorry, I'm a rabbinical Jew, and I'm expecting you to follow the rabbis, and you're not good with them, you're not good with me. So what would your initial thoughts be about that? Besides what any Makorah say, what would you think about such a thing? If you fulfill a level d'oraisa, you fulfill a mitzvah the way the Torah asks you to do it, what should that count for? Hi.
Maybe like a
chetzi kiyum. A chetzi kiyum. Okay, so that's an interesting concept by itself, right? And that could actually take us down a whole different avenue to explore. Is there such a thing as a chetzi kiyum? You know, what does that mean? So, why chatzi? Why don't we say it's full for something else? It's the full mitzvah the Torah asks for, and the rabbis are coming from a different place. Chief Rabbi?
More of a bidyevet.
Okay, that's more and less than he's saying, right? You're saying that it's like a full mitzvah, but l'chachila we're supposed to do the drabanas. But if you don't, yeah, it's also good. It's also a mitzvah. Okay, that's what you would have thought. Okay. Yes, sir?
A joke. It's okay.
Is it very funny?
I think it's very funny.
All right, so the stakes are high, because it's going to have to, will it reflect some kind of insight on the... Okay, so then...
this guy, his name is Joe.
Uh-huh.
And Joe's a good Jew. He went through his whole life. He fulfilled...
Stakes are very high.
Right? He was a good Jew, Joe. But the thing was, everything he did, all of the mitzvos he did according to the most lenient opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, no matter what it was, he wanted to know what the most lenient opinion was, just to fulfill his chiyuv and be done with it. And after 120, Joe passes on, and he gets up to Olam Haba, and he's excited. And, you know, he's waiting in line, finally gets to the front, and the malach there says, oh, you're Joe, all right, come with me, you're on the list. And they're walking through the neighborhoods, and you see the big houses and the nice cars and all the fancy things that Olam Haba has to offer. And finally, they get to this little cardboard box. And the malach hands him a skateboard and says, here you go, here's your house and here's your car. And Joe says, you're shortchanging me. What about the big houses and the nice cars? And the Malach says, well, this is all Haba, according to the most lenient opinion.
Ouch. And then Joe says, well, I fooled you, because you don't really need a car in all Haba. So the joke's on you. And it turns out the little box is really a sukkah. And then they walk to the Twilight Zone. Is that really the right way to look at it? Is it a question of lenience? Is that basically, you know, similar to the B'diavad language, you know, that, well, the Machmirim, they follow the rabbinic law. But the lenient ones, is that really the whole mechanics, or is it maybe even something more profound?
Well, I think that there's two things. You know, sometimes, you know, obviously it's, you know, if one had to choose which one would be better, I think everyone would say following the rabbis would be better. Is that what you're asking?
I think we can all take as a given, right? If we understand the rabbinic law is binding, so it's at least better. But the question is that all we're calling it just better? Or is it even something more fundamental? Is it maybe something that comes to redefine the mitzvah? And that maybe the mitzvah isn't going to exist anymore in its previous form. So this is something which comes out of our daf, because Tolstoy brings up the issue of rabbinic enactments, in this case Xeris, that affect the mitzvah sukkah. Right? By Torah law, it's okay if a person is sitting in his house and he has a sukkah right by his door of his house, and he has a table, let's say the other way around, to the table in the house, and he's sitting in the sukkah. So he's technically in the sukkah, but his table is in the house. So by Torah law, that's okay. But Chazal recognized that a man always follows his dinner table. So if the table is in the stay in the house, pretty soon you're going to be in the house also. So they made a rabbinic declaration that it's not going to work. Your table has to be in the sukkah too. So, what would happen if one would say, okay, but I'm a Torah Jew, so I'm going to sit inside the sukkah, the Torah says. I'm not going to worry about this rabbinic thing about the table being with me. So do we say, you are still in fulfillment of the Torah's command? Or do we say, no, the rabbis make the rules, this no longer works even on a Torah level. So, before looking at anything else, let me just ask you, what of those two statements, what seems more intuitive to you? What's the strength and weakness of either possibility? Again, two possibilities being you can say I'm the Torah Jew, and I'll stick with that. Or to say, no, the Torah no longer recognizes this mitzvah. Sammy?
Drawing a fundamental point, meaning you're defining the mitzvah at that point. You're saying that in order to, you know,
in this case? Is you're defining who's
I'm
you?
The
rabbi,
right? So we're saying that, you know, Rugo Rosh Hashanah is midaray. So that's how you have to do it. If you're not, then it's as if you didn't do it. But regardless of it, you know, the rabbi's kind of came in and said, you know, this is how you need to.
Right, so what I'm asking you is that possible? So we seem to see two angles here. Either that's true, they can redefine the mitzvah, or it's not true. They're going to impose legislation, but that legislation doesn't necessarily change the base mitzvah. The mitzvah sticks to its original format. So what's appealing and what's less appealing about either possibility? Ariel?
So first one, I'm talking most often about that we should be I would have thought just simply that that's a separate mitzvah. I mean, that's a mitzvah, but not that that like enters every single mitzvah, and that now that kind of like can either remove the mitzvah if you don't follow the rabbinic decree order, like how they detail the mitzvah, or like you will fulfill it. Like I think that's like a separate mitzvah, but not that it's going to actually change every single mitzvah.
Okay, so you're asking along the...
Torah already decreed like 600 days on their mitzvah. How could the rabbis now, Rabbanim now, affect whether you're Mekayim or not?
Okay, so now you're saying two things. Just to clarify what I think you're saying. Is first, you pose around Sardia, I'll take a question in a second. That first, you pose kind of a lamdash al-chakir. That we know that there is rabbinic authority. How do we know that? It's actually not so obvious. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we have this idea that rabbinic law is binding, rabbinic instruction is binding. So how should we view that? To use alumnusha terms, do we see that as some kind of a external independent concept that you have to listen to the rabbis? And if you don't do that, then you're in violation of that, but that exists in a vacuum. And therefore, you could be in trouble for that that discrete mitzvah, but it's not going to impact anything else. Or should we say that no, that rabbinic authority is deeper than that, and it's a general concept which attaches itself to the whole Torah. And it means that the rabbinic authority comes to define everything else, and a failure to comply with rabbinic authority could impact on every level of the Torah. So that, I think, is the question we were saying at first, right?
Yeah,
like a chakira.
Also hinges on the fact that you're mekayim mitzvah, you're not mekayim mitzvah.
Okay.
You have to do it.
So the second part of what you're saying, so the first part could exist as a lamdusha question by itself.
But you're
active. Okay. So the first part could exist as a lamdusha question by itself. But right now, I'm more interested in the second thing that I think you're saying, that just the question, how can they? And like, if the Torah is from God, and the Torah says this is what you have to do, and we did that. So then, how does it work? Does it work that the rabbis can come in and say, sorry, it's no longer any good? So I just want to focus on that for a second as what bothers us. We're saying, looking for what's appealing and what's not appealing about the possibilities here. That's a little troubling. And why is it troubling? It's troubling because if we believe the Torah is divine and it's coming from God, so then we're very wary of anything that will tamper with it in any direction. So if the Torah says this is good enough, so how can you tell me that now it's not true anymore because of something that human beings declare? So that raises a little bit of a red flag. Right? That's... Okay, we know that it's not the same kind of tampering with the Torah that we're usually concerned about, but how can we allow any tampering with the Torah? Isn't that something that's a very dangerous path to go down? So from that perspective, maybe we're a little more comfortable saying, listen, okay, the rabbis can tell us additional things to do or not to do. And that exists in the realm of rabbinic law. But the Torah law is untouchable. So if I'm fulfilling the Torah law, it should still exist like that. So,
isn't this tampering, though, based or caused because the Torah is ambiguous? Meaning...
Is it?
Meaning the Torah doesn't say you can't. Doesn't say, you know, this is a sukkah, you have to have your table in your sukkah with you. The rabbanim came in and they said, we have this concept of sukkah, how do you fulfill that mitzvah?
Is that true, though? I mean, that's something to consider. And sometimes, in some cases, especially when we talk about halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, for example, we find that this is often the case. Right? The Torah tells us to wear tefillin. And we have no idea what tefillin are. We open up the English and we find out that they're frontless. Okay. Slack boots. So what are frontless? What are frontless? It's not going to tell us anything. So we need, in this case, the tradition, the Sinaitic tradition, to tell us what it means. Are you saying that that's the role the rabbis are playing here? I'm not sure that's true. Right? It seems that, no, we have a clear understanding that as far as the Torah is concerned, the mitzvah doesn't require this. And yeah, we know the rabbis, later on, are coming and telling us, well, we're changing the rules. So are we okay with the rules being changed?
But isn't that whole understanding of sukkah based on what the rabbis declared as what a
is? Some to a certain extent, but that doesn't cover what we're talking about here. Right? There are things that we don't know in terms of what the Torah is talking about.
And therefore, yes, there's a role the rabbis play in telling us what the Torah is asking for. But let's say if we're focusing on this example, we know that's not what we're claiming. Right? No one is claiming that the Torah said that you have to have your table with you in the sukkah. So what happens when the rabbis say that? Are we comfortable saying that they could change the Torah? Yes,
sir. Sorry, I kept waiting for a while. Okay. It's basically the Torah. Isn't there an idea that by being over asserting the rabbanim, you're over asserting the isur deraisa of not listening to
rabbanim? Possibly. And if so, then what?
If so, then I guess by that with an isur deraisa that has a gezeirah derabanan comes another mitzvah deraisa. That I guess.
See, so at least they're competing on an even field.
Right. Yeah,
okay, that's something to explore. I think I see what you're getting at. That we shouldn't feel so uncomfortable here that we're tampering with the Torah. It's the Torah tampering with itself. The Torah created the whole mechanism to allow that to happen, and perhaps that's why it works. So that's definitely something we're going to need to explore. I think I see where you're going with that. So on the one hand, we have to see, can we be comfortable with the Torah's rules changing on a basic level? But on the other hand, if not, what does it mean to be a rabbinic Jew? What does it mean to have rabbinic legislation and to have a system of Judaism which reveres the rabbis while allowing ourselves to dispense with their regulations as we see fit? So there is a certain tension here, and we're going to get into a lot more detail about this probably tomorrow, but just to lay down the basic machlokes on our daf that prompts this issue is that on the question of a sukkah that doesn't follow rabbinic law, so you saw the Tosis here. I could have told you just to look at the end of Tosis, but it gave you the satisfaction of going through the whole thing. But the last line of Tosis, right, so here, this line, lo kiyamta mitzvah sukkah miyanachem. Right, the idea that an individual, Rav Yochanan ben Acharonis, was visited, and the Mishnah tells us in Sukkah and Daf Chav Ches, you saw that, and the Gemara appears in Maseches Brachos as well, in the first parak, that this individual, Rav Yochanan ben Acharonis, was found, Shei Yoshe Roshu Verubo B'Sukkah V'Shulchanu B'Soch HaBayis. He was found in violation of the rabbinic rule. And what did they say to him? Imkein ha'yisa noeg lo kiyamta mitzvah sukkah mi yamecha. That's if you've always done it like this your whole life, then you have never fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah.
So that creates a lot of problems because there's plenty of machlokas, and Brachos, Beisila said, Rashi said, just like Beisharmai would say, you know, it's according if you follow Beisila, Beisila would say the same thing Beisharmai. So then, like the many, many areas where we have machlokas, according to the other opinion, you would be Yotze, Midoraisa.
Right, that's filled with challenges, and that gets into a whole other element. But first, before we even get to that, here we're saying, okay, here we can agree there's rabbinic legislation, and everyone's clear on what should happen here. So here the issue isn't machlokas, the issue is the difference between rabbinic law and Torah law. That here somebody wasn't following unanimously agreed upon rabbinic law, and he was told that if that's the way you do things, you've never fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah. So that's striking, right? You haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah, but he followed all the rules of the Torah. So what does Tosfos on our daf say? Yeah, sorry. Lo kiyamtim sukkah mecha dafilu mi d'oraisa lo kiyam. That even on a level min ha-Torah. Very, very striking statement. And by the way, I didn't put the Rambam on this. If you look at the Rambam, the Rambam's language is similar. So I can give you for tomorrow, the Rambam's position, his expression of this din, seems to say the same thing, that somebody who were to violate this, it's ki'ilu lo achol. It's as if he did not eat in the sukkah. Now, who disagrees with this? The Ran. Right? The Ran comments here. The Ran comments really on the second parak, on the Mishnah. So what does the Ran say about this concept, lo ki'amtim mitzvah sukkah mi'amecha? You didn't do it l'charchiva. The language a little bit extreme. Right here, it's brief also, so we can read it together. So here the Ram's language is, well, avdavka. Yeah, okay, don't get so crazy. Because this prohibition is a rabbinic prohibition, maybe you will follow your table. Here's what he's really saying. Lo kiyamta mitzvas sukkah kiroi ukiratzin chachamim. You didn't do it the perfect way, the way the rabbis asked you to do it. Uchud detnan parakar v'psachim. That this is evocative of a more famous context that we know from the Haggadah, from the Seder night. We say kol mishul amar shloshu dvarim elu pesach liyotzi dechavaso. So liyotzi dechavaso, you're not yotze. It sounds like you're not fulfillment of the Torah mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Says Rana kolomar shlo kiyem mitzvasan kiroi. It sounds like it means you didn't do it perfectly. You didn't do it. That would be too much to say. You didn't do it perfectly. You stand me up first.
Let's say, like a rub today. This is like, especially like this that I find so interesting because...
They're very interesting.
You see the difference between Tosfos and the Ram, and they're like very fundamental differences. Because
they're pretty explicit about being opposite of each other.
Right. So, like, if you're...
But they don't quote each other. Well, they don't quote each other, but they say things that are clearly opposites.
When someone's, let's say, passing a shayla, and it comes down to the fundamentals of the din, and you see the source, you see two different sources like this, what are you supposed to...
So that's a fantastic question. It's a little bit of like a Sunday topic or a lunch topic, because it's going to take us very far afield. There's a lot to say about that. It's a very worthwhile discussion to have. It's just one that will not allow us to get anywhere in this again. So... save it for one of the opportunities that we'll hopefully have soon to discuss such things. Very, very worthwhile question. Just take us out of our topic here.
Any difference between the Ram and the Ritva?
So the Ritva sounds similar to the Ram, right? The Ritva basically seems to be saying the same thing, that no, this language is a little bit overstated or a little bit hyperbolic perhaps, but the mitzvah, of course, you are fulfilling. So this... We're just going to put this on the table right now. There's a lot more to say about this. I mean, we'll probably do more of that tomorrow because there's a lot to explore about the dynamics between the Ran and Tosfos on this point. And there are many other scenarios one could come up with where this question could be asked. Just off the top of our heads, and we'll explore this in more detail, could you think of other types of interactions between Torah and rabbinic law that could prompt questions like this? Sorry? Yeah, anywhere. It could be inside, anywhere in halacha, but a different type of question.
It's not Kriya Shema. It's not
okay.
Specifically that you're doing it like a different... it's the same.
Okay, so then we'll explore the Kriya Shema thing in a second, because that you've already seen today. Okay, so what about Tekiah Shofar?
Maybe you go.
What about Tekiah Shofar? Sorry?
There's a Takana. You should do all the three different opinions.
Okay, I think you were going to go a different direction with that in a sec. But, okay, where are you...
I was going to say Shabbos, and don't close Shabbos.
Okay, so what about...
That's different, though.
It is different, that's why I'm asking. There are different kind of cases, right? And we'll talk about all of these, right? But what's a different type of situation? Here you have, let's say, if the rabbi has prohibited you from doing a mitzvah, and you do it anyway, what's the status? That's going to be a fascinating question. We'll have to see that. Tell me your names.
Ben Book,
great name.
Thank you. Yes.
Where are people who look? So what about Chatzishir?
The Rabban advised not focusing more about whether or not this
Nisar Achila
of Chatzishir
on top of
the
Shir Kakusavas or Kazai's Regulus or Yechiv. It's Machlok's Minotaur.
Yeah.
Everyone agrees it's a prohibition. Right, so that's an example of, you say, whether you... How does that no affect this question?
You're making the Isser more stringent by saying that this is a regular...
If you say it's an Isser Drabbanan. Okay. So the question, how would something like that affect the dinner? Or let's say the other way around. Let's say if it's by a mitzvah. And let's say you do less than the full share of the mitzvah. But let's try to narrow down some of these examples. We'll go into more detail about it later. These are all fascinating. Let's say, on the one hand, here we have a situation in our case where you have a mitzvah and there's a gzeira about how you do the mitzvah. Right? We also have heard an example of where there's another mitzvah and the Torah prohibits you from doing the mitzvah in the first place? What other kinds of examples could you have? Do you have your hand up? Sorry. I thought there was a hand up over here. Okay.
Okay.
What's your name?
AJ Book.
AJ Book, okay. This is a great. We're people of the book. So Erev Chatzeres, how does that...
Because technically, you have a bunch of Torah together, a mavoi doesn't on the Doraisa level doesn't require a korum. However, one does require a chateros on the Ravana level to join them all together.
So that's an example where the rabbinic law changes the environment quite literally, right? So what impact is that going to have on say mitzvos that are performed?
If you don't have an Erev Chatzeros technically on the Doraisa level, you are able to carry in that courtyard, but on your bottom level, since everyone's house is a different reshus, it's technically going from one reshus to the other on your bottom level. So at your bottom level,
it changes the reality of what you're doing.
Yeah,
which is interesting also. There's a lot of interesting angles to explore here, but I think just to throw one more thing onto the fire, and we'll get into more detail about this. What about mitzvos that the rabbis added on to? Can you think of any examples of that? Sorry? Oh, well, those are the mitzvos that they added out completely. But what about mitzvos that are Torah mitzvos that the rabbis expanded the obligation? Mitzvahs asay, just pure asay. Lulav, because they added the time, right? So from one day to 7 days. But that actually would have a different dynamic. But just to give two examples that come to mind of what I'm talking about here, say Kiddush. Right? Kiddush is a mitzvah in our Torah, according to almost everybody, right? Not only is it a mitzvah in our Torah, it's one of the Ten Commandments. Zachar, Shomer Shabbos, L'kadsho. But nowadays, when we make Kiddush, what does that entail? It entails, let's say, that we, Friday night, we stand at the table where we're having our meal, and we recite a bracha over a cup of wine. Is all of that Minhag Torah? Probably not. It's a big machlokas, what is included in Zachar Hashem Shabbos L'kadsho. I once saw a certain sefer that listed 15 different shitas in the poskim as to what is included in Zachar Shomer Shabbos L'kadsho. But there's a good likelihood the Torah doesn't require you to be at your dinner table. The Torah doesn't require you to make a bracha. The Torah doesn't require you to have a cup of wine. So all of those are rabbinic details. So what happens if somebody says, okay, I'm a Torah Jew, I'm going to make Kiddush Friday night, I'm going to say Zachar Shomer Shabbos L'kadsho. No wine, no meal, no bracha. Did he fulfill anything? Yeah. What about benching? V'achalta v'sevata v'erecht is a Torah obligation. But nowadays, to fulfill benching, we recite four brachos. Plus, l'arachem anzor. Even if you leave those out, before you get to that, you have four brachos. So those brachos are not all menat Torah. So what if somebody says, okay, I'm a Torah Jew, I'm not going to say all of those. Did he fulfill anything? So these are big questions. They have big ramifications. Right? And they all have to do with this interaction of rabbinic law and Torah law, which I thought maybe was a little similar to what you were getting at in terms of shofar then, in terms of how to do it.
In the Rashi, he said that, I thought they mentioned specifically in that Sergei Rosh Hashanah that everyone who had been doing it one way,
same as
somebody else, wasn't necessarily doing it correctly.
So, okay, it's a good perspective to bring to it. So basically, do you see how we just said three different categories? Right, we have our sugya, a mitzvah, which Chazal said don't do a certain way because of problems. We have something like blowing shofar on Shabbos, where we have a mitzvah that the rabbis told us not to do at all because of concerns of a different area of halacha. And then we have positive mitzvahs like Kiddush and benching, where the Torah tells us to do them, and the relatively simple way to do that. And the rabbis add it on, and the question come up, what if I fall short? So all of these are areas which may have different rules, three different kinds of categories perhaps, and maybe there are more. But all of these provoke the question of, how can Torah law be affected by rabbinic legislation? So now let's take a step back and give some basics here. Where does rabbinic authority come from? So very possibly the pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, which was the first of the Makaros today, so hopefully you saw that. So there, that is the source for rabbinic authority. Comment? Oh, okay, that's a question of itself. Who are the rabbis that we're talking about? That's an important question. There's a lot to say about that, but there's even, before we get to that, other details. So, according to the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim and in the Sefer HaMitzvos, that is the source for rabbinic authority. The authority to make new legislation. Happens to be the Ramban disagrees, and there's a lot to figure out about that. So that we'll discuss down the line. But for now, let's work with the Rambam's view that this is where we find an obligation to follow rabbinic law. So what does that mean? It means that they can interpret the Torah. And according to the Rambam, it also means more than that. And it also means that not only can they interpret the Torah, but they can also tell you to follow them when they are giving legislation that goes beyond the Torah. And that was part of what the Ramban didn't accept. Because these are two different functions. And to use the model of the United States of America, and we know that we have a separation of powers in our government. We have three branches of government. And two of the branches are legislative and judiciary. And those are intentionally and carefully kept separate in American government. The Rambam is saying this pasuk talks about both. Right, judiciary authority, to use the American model, means the judges have the role of telling you what existing law means. If there's something that is ambiguous about the Constitution or about existing state laws, then the judges on every level, it's their job to tell you what the law means. And whatever they say is binding. That's what it means to be a judge. They get to have binding authority when they tell you what it means. But they're not allowed to tell you what they think the law should be. They can only tell you what they think the law is. If they think society needs a better law, but it's not the one that they can honestly say is in the Constitution or is in the existing code, a judge can't do anything about that. That would be called, or officially not supposed to do anything about that, that's what's called, critically, legislating from the bench. And the bench he's supposed to interpret, he's not supposed to say, this is what the law should be.
Alex? Isn't there some kind of concept of judicial activism, though?
It's a controversial concept.
Kind of stretching.
Yeah,
it's kind of like almost what rabbis can also do.
So let's figure this out. Well, that practically speaking, the rabbis can do that, but is it fair to say that it's all contained in this pasuk? Because since we know a judge's role, if we look to the secular model of the contemporary America, a judge's role is supposed to not be activist. It's supposed to be telling you what the law is. So maybe that's all the pasuk means. Now, if you don't know what the Torah wants, you don't know what the actual existing mitzvahs ask of you, so then you go to the rabbinic authorities and you have to listen to their interpretation of the Torah. But if they say, well, the Torah says this, but we also think you should do X, Y, and Z also, how do you know that that's contained in this pasuk? The Ramban said he didn't think it's so clear that that's from this pasuk. So the Rambam was telling us a chiddush, a controversial chiddush, that the pasuk lo sasur is the source for two things. The source for judiciary authority. The rabbis have binding authority to tell you what the Torah means as is. And also legislative authority. The rabbis can make new laws. And these new laws are going to be binding, and you're going to have to listen to them. Now, there's a lot of confusion and discussion about the end of the pasuk. How does that pasuk end? What phrase? Yam and Ismaels we're looking for, right? Not to the right or to the left. So what does that mean? This is now nowadays we use right wing, left wing as religious descriptions, political descriptions. That is a result of the French Parliament. That is not the way the Torah was using the terminology. Right and left did not mean things in that context. So what does it mean, right and left? Not to turn to the... What do the words mean? So...
I think it was the Rambam also says that even if they're abundant and tell you to do something totally opposite, meaning that the right is the left, the left is the right, then you still have to follow them even though that it appears to you that it's totally opposite of what the Torah says.
So Rashi in Chumash quotes a Medrash, quotes Sifra, that has provoked a lot of confusion, or a lot of debate. Because Rashi tells us that what the phrase means is afilu yomru lecha al yamin shu small, al small shu yamin, you should listen. That even if the rabbis tell you right is left and left is right, it's still binding. That's what right and left means. Hi.
It's on the Torah Kedima. Uh-huh. Or the Yerushalmi, that's the opposite.
Okay, so even the Bavli is going to tell us the opposite. The problem is, that interpretation seems very tricky. Like, what does that interpretation seem to mean? Even if they tell you right is left and left is right, you're supposed to listen. What does it sound like it means?
Whatever they say,
even if they are
wrong,
right? It sounds like even if they're wrong. They tell you something factually incorrect, you're still supposed to listen. That is problematic as a interpretation, not just because maybe it'll bother you conceptually, but it's not true aliba de halacha. How do we know it's not true aliba de halacha? There's a whole masechta about it. What masechta is that? Horios. Right? Masechta Horios tells us what to do if the Bez Din HaGadol makes a mistake. So clearly we consider it possible that the Bez Din HaGadol can make a mistake. It could say something that is wrong. And the first Mishnah in Horias tells us that you are responsible for your own mistakes as an individual if you follow the Bez Din HaGadol when they're wrong. In other words, you're not supposed to be following them when they're wrong. And if you do that anyway, you're in trouble. If you didn't know they were wrong, so then under some circumstances, it's their problem. But if you knew they were wrong, that's your problem. That's a big responsibility. But the clear implication is that it's possible for the Bez Din HaGadol to be wrong, and you're not supposed to follow them if they're wrong. So it's a big problem to read this Rashi simply and say, okay, I should have put the Rashi in my phone, by the way. Sorry about that. But take a look at the Rashi tomorrow. But that Rashi sounds like he's saying just do whatever they say. That's a problem. Conceptually, it's a problem. Halachically, it doesn't seem to actually be the din. Our receptor is fond of relating that the great novelist Herman Wouk taught here at Yeshiva University. So he maintained that his play The Cain Mutiny is based on Rashi and Chumash, this Rashi, and that the message is that authority is always right.
Who's it?
Rav Schechter quotes Herman Wouk as saying this. Then Rav Schechter goes on to add that it's the wrong shot in Rashi, because Rashi can't mean that. Rashi can't mean that authority is always right, because that's not really the din. Now, to be fair to Herman Wouk, it is a little bit of a debate. There are other Afronim who do read Rashi this way, because it does sound like that's what he's saying. But the most likely interpretation, and the way actually the Midrashic languages and other sources, is what do you think it means? If we're not really supposed to follow halacha when it's wrong, follow the Rabbanim when they're wrong, so what do you think Rashi does mean then? What's the most likely interpretation?
It seems illogical.
Right? Afilu nirin be'einecha. So surprising, Lipsaki, you got. You thought it was going to be the exact opposite. So it seems to you like you should have said something completely else. So, okay, so that, the message we can accept, that, no, that you're supposed to understand that the rabbis are holding in the sugya more than you are, and you would have guessed, and we all can come up with stories where this happened, you would have expected a completely opposite psak from the one you got. Okay, so even though you're surprised, you're supposed to follow them anyway. That's a more workable interpretation. And it leaves room that if you happen to know with actual, genuine confidence that it's a real error, okay, so then you wouldn't follow. And that's what Maseches Horeis is talking about. Some of the Rishonim suggest that maybe there's another path here. That maybe what we're talking about is not necessarily a mistake, but is still so different from the halacha that it's like left is right and right is left. How is that possible? So there's some who suggest that this phrase, Yaman Usmol, together with this medrash, is the source for a fascinating concept which appears in the Gemara Maseches Yevamos. I did not put this, I went back and forth about whether to put this on the Marmar Komos list. The reason I didn't is because it's kind of a sprawling discussion over a full blot of Gemara. So I'll tell you about it, then you can look at it afterwards. But I didn't want to put this on the list because it was hard just to extract the part that's most relevant to us. But the Gemara and Yevamos, and Daf Peites and Daf Tzadi, it's a sprawling discussion. The Gemara tells us a fascinating concept. Yesh koach bidei chachamim lakor dover minhag Torah v'sheva al tasef. That the rabbis have authority, so much so that not only can they create a new prohibition that wasn't there before, not only can they create a new mitzvah that wasn't there before, but they can even contradict the Torah. Now, there are limits. The limits are debated in the Gemara. But the way we conclude is that the most prominent limit is it has to be basically passive, b'shev al tasef. But it's still quite a thing. What it means is that, for example, the rabbis can tell us, don't blow shofar on Shabbos. Don't take a lulav on Shabbos. Etc., etc. They're not going to tell us to eat treif. They're not going to tell us to be mechal Shabbos. They're not going to tell us to actively violate the Torah. That would be called kum v'yaseh. But shev al tasah, that much they can do. This is a very striking concept. That idea that the rabbis can tell us to ignore the Torah, or can perhaps rewrite the Torah, we'll have to figure out which one it is, that's a pretty big chiddush, but that's what the Gemara seems to be saying. Yesh koach lakor davar min haTorah. So there are those who suggest that maybe that's what it means in the Pasuk in Shoftim when it says Yomin Usmol. Right, this will work specifically within the Rambam's interpretation that we read this Pasuk in a legislative sense. If you read it in a judiciary sense, it's going to be harder. If you say that the rabbis have the ability to tell you what the Torah means, even when they're wrong about what the Torah means, that's a problem. That brings us into questions and conflicts with Horeis and the like. But if we read this pasuk in a legislative sense, then perhaps that's what it's saying. The rabbis can make new rules. Right? Do not deviate from the new rules that the rabbis make. And a few yamin is small, even if they're going to tell you yamin is small, small is too yamin, even if their new rules will contradict the existing principles of the Torah, we're still telling you, listen to the rules. Okay? Everyone following so far? So, this is the most dramatic statement that we have one of them, that the rabbinic authority extends even to affecting the performance of Torah principles in ways that may contradict the Torah. And the most famous example, the easiest one to focus on, is the one just mentioned, that we know that we're supposed to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and the Torah does not distinguish between days of the week. Whenever Rosh Hashanah is, that's when we blow shofar. But the rabbis came and said, no, if it's Shabbos, don't. We're supposed to take a lulav and esrog. They used the sukkah-oriented example. We're supposed to take a lulav and esrog on the first day of Sukkot. But the rabbi said, if it's Shabbos, don't do it. So let's try to explore a little bit. How do we understand this concept? And this concept is fascinating. One of the most prominent explanations of this topic is that of Rabbi Chaim Wasserman, who has a truly beautiful essay. It's really a very satisfying, elegant piece of lundus that can be found in two places in his svarim. One is that Rabbi Chanan has the titles of Rabbi Chanan's svarim are a little funny. You know the whole thing about how you park in a driveway and drive in a parkway? Right? The language that seems to be backwards. So Rabbi Chanan's two major svarim are the Kovetz Ha'aros and the Kovetz Shirim. So the Kovetz Ha'aros are these long, beautiful, intricate shirim. And the Kovetz Shirim are these short little haros. I don't know who chose the titles or how it ended up that way, but that's the way it is. So the Kovetz Haaros and Yivamos, so there is this discussion on the Sugi and Yivamos over there, Peites and Tzadi. And pretty much identically has the same piece in a subsection called Kuntres Divrei Sofrim. Kuntres Divrei Sofrim is published together with the Kovetz Haaros, Kovetz Shirim. The shorter haros, there are long essays also there. That's called, there are five essays that make up a section called Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, about topics of the Rabbanan. So this appears in both places. He has the essay in the Kuntres Divrei Sofrim and also in the Sefer on Yavamos. And it's quite a beautiful essay. And what he does is he posits three questions. And the three questions you will ultimately come to see are tied into each other. So we'll first mention what the questions are, and then we'll go into greater detail as it relates to our sugya. So the first question that we need to figure out is the question that affects our sugya. What does that language mean? Yesh koach la'akor d'dor min ha'Torah. That is very extreme sounding language. And that was the literal translation of those words.
The power to uproot.
Power to uproot things from the Torah. The power to rewrite the Torah. That expression that we were uncomfortable with at the beginning today sounds like that's what the Gemara is saying. Right? And this does raise major theological questions. If we believe the Torah is inviolate, and we're very uncomfortable with any tampering, so to say that it means what it literally sounds like, that's a little surprising. Right, so, yesh koach la'akor d'avr min ha'Torah, that they have the authority to uproot something from the Torah itself, that's a pretty powerful idea. Or, alternatively, you could say, no, it's too much for us. It doesn't mean that. The rabbis cannot rewrite the Torah. What it means is, rabbinic legislation is binding. And it's binding even when it contradicts the Torah. The Torah is chai v'kayim. Nothing is going to change that ever. But rabbinic legislation is also binding for whatever reason. It's interesting to explore why we have to put so much weight on it, but that's the case. And we're told to follow it even when it contradicts the Torah. So essentially, that's our machlokas here.
Or let's give the example of the shofar. Let's say somebody does blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it falls out on Shabbos. Did he at least do a mitzvah? Right, after 120, can he, let's say he did nothing else his whole life. So after 120, he comes up to Shemaim, he says, I got that one shofar blowing, so what about that? And maybe he's, the Malach's going to tell him, bad luck, that one shofar that you did, that was nothing, because that was Shabbos. So, which is it? Do you have a mitzvah there? So this is a major, major question. Rabbi Akiva Eiger brought up this question many places which discuss this question. We'll go into more depth about it. Now we just want to explain how it fits into the whole story here. Right, these are essentially our two possibilities. Right, do we say that, yeah, you do fulfill a mitzvah, because as far as the Torah is concerned, there's a mitzvah to blow shofar on that day. So if you did that, that's a mitzvah. Rabbis can't rewrite the Torah. They have the authority to tell you don't blow shofar, despite the fact that it contradicts the Torah's mitzvah. That they can do. But if you did it, still a mitzvah. Or should we say, no, we'll say more than that. We'll say, yesh koach la'akor davar min ha-Torah, the mitzvah is gone. There's no longer any mitzvah to blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah that year. When it falls out on Shabbos, the mitzvah has been erased. And if you chose to blow shofar, no points. All you have is the avera of ignoring rabbinic law, and you don't have any mitzvah at all. So those seem to be the two possible ways to read this phrase. And Rabbi Chanan asks, which one is it? We'll go into much more detail about that tomorrow. I just want to kind of introduce the whole topic now. But I'll mention one fascinating example, which Rabbi Chanan mentions. I should give you some Gemaras to, you know, I'll mention this fascinating example tomorrow. I'll give you the examples to look at first. But let's look at his other questions also. So question number one is, what does the phrase mean? Does the phrase mean the mitzvah is really erased? Or does it mean that, no, the mitzvah is there, but the rabbis can tell you to follow them and not to follow the Torah? That seems to be the issue on our daf. Right, the rabbi said you can't sit in the sukkah with your table in the house. What was the impact of that? Did they erase the mitzvah? There's no longer a mitzvah? Like Tosfos says, like the Rambam sounds like? Or do we say, no, they have no such authority. It's not possible to do that. They have the authority to tell you what to do. And therefore, they can tell you, don't sit in the sukkah under these circumstances. But if you did it, and it follows the Torah specifications, then it's done. So this is Rabbi Chanan's first question. Essentially, do we follow Tosfos on our daf, or do we follow the Rambam? Who is right about this relationship? Okay, so far so good. Now we get into more detail about this tomorrow. We'll see that one could possibly split the difference. Right, one might say that in this issue, Tosfos and the Rambam, I feel one way, but the question of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah maybe is a different dynamic. Or the question of making Kiddush without being B'makom Suda might be a third dynamic. There could be any number of nuances in terms of the question, but broadly speaking, this is the whole topic of the first question. Does the rabbinic legislation rewrite the Torah? Or no, that's impossible. All it does is tell us what to do, and the Kiddush is, it's binding even when it contradicts the Torah. Then maybe that's the pasuk. Lo sasam and adavar, follow rabbinic legislation, even yamin or small, even if they tell you right is left, even if they knowingly, not a mistake, they knowingly contradict the Torah, it's still going to be mine. Okay, so far so good. So just to mention Rabbi Chanan's other two points, I'll try to get that for today. So Rabbi Chanan also raises two other questions. He says one question is, the Gemara says, the conclusion is, this only works b'sheva al tasa, right? It only works passively. So how do you define passive versus active? So we gave the example before, they'll tell us not to blow shofar, but they won't tell us to violate Shabbos. Those are easy examples because they don't pose any questions. Meaning that shofar is clearly a mitzvah saseh, it's clearly an active mitzvah. And chilul Shabbos is clearly a lo saseh. So we see how it plays out here. The rabbis could tell us, sit out passively the mitzvah of shofar, sheva al tasa. But they won't tell you kum va'aseh v'machal Shabbos. But I could come up with some examples that are a little less obvious. Let's say, for example, you push off a burial. So that is phrased as a lo saseh in the Torah, lo salin nivlaso. You're not allowed to delay the burial. But one does that passively, right? One does that by just not doing anything. So what is our category here? Are we talking categorically? Aseis are in one group and los aseis are another group? Or are we talking about behavior? Anything that you do passively, you just sit back and don't do something, that is fair game here, even if technically it would be a los aseis. And anything that would require you to actively contradict the Torah, that we can't do, even if it would have been viewed as a mitzvah saseh. Okay, that's the second question. Everyone got it? Want to follow the second question? Yes, question is, what do we mean when we say sheva al tasa? You can sit out something, but we won't actively make you do something wrong. Are we defining that simply by categories, positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs? Even if you'll have a quirk once in a while, a negative mitzvah that you violate passively, like not burying someone, we'll still call that sheva al tasa? Or do we mean, no, we're defining things by behavior. The Torah, the rabbis can tell you to sit back and ignore the Torah, even if that means you're in violation of a lo saseh, but they'll never tell you to actively do something wrong. Okay? So far, so good? The third question, asks Rav Yochanan, is why is it that this is a limitation at all? If the rabbis can contradict the Torah, then let's go all the way, let them contradict whatever they want. Why do we have this limitation of sheva al tasa? So he has two theories. He wants to know which theory is right. One theory could be, it's simply a question of degree. We generally assume that violating an Aveira is worse than not doing a mitzvah. We call a sin of commission. Doing an Aveira is worse than omission of just not doing something you're supposed to do. Right, that's the general premise that we have. Is that premise correct? Maybe, maybe not. The biggest proof that it's correct is onshin, that the Torah, for the most part, gives punishments for violating an active Aveira. And usually there aren't punishments associated with neglecting a mitzvah, which supports the impression that it's a bigger offense to the Torah to commit an active aveira than to just leave out a mitzvah. So maybe it's just a question of degree. It's a big deal to do an active aveira. It's a little bit less of a big deal to skip a mitzvah. So the rabbis, they have some power, not that much. They can tell you to skip a mitzvah, that's only a level 6 offense. But to tell you to do an Aveira, that's a level 10 offense, that much they can't do. It's just a question of degree. That's one possibility. The other possibility he has is that, no, it's not a question of degree. It has to do with the mechanics of what's happening. That essentially, you're between a rock and a hard place. That you have the Torah saying, you better blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. I don't care what day of the week it is, you better blow shofar. On the other hand, you have the rabbis saying, oh no, you better not blow that shofar. If it's Shabbos, you cannot blow shofar. So you're stuck. What do you do? Mommy's telling you blow the shofar, daddy's telling you don't blow the shofar. So you can't satisfy them both. It's mutually exclusive.
But in general, the safest approach when you have an impossible situation is, like we say, shev al tazodif. At least stay out of it. So at least you're not actively offending anyone. So is that the idea? Maybe it's not a question of degree. It's just a question of you can't satisfy both of these contradictory instructions. So the safest thing to do is just stay out of it. Everyone follow? So these three questions, Rav Elchanan points out, are all interlinked. It's all one issue. That if you believe that the Torah is actually being rewritten by the rabbis, a mitzvah is actually being pulled out, so then you might say, okay, there's limits to how far that can go, because that's a pretty radical thing. And therefore, maybe we'll distinguish based on assays versus los assays, because maybe assays are less severe than los assays, and that all is relevant to the question of limits of degree. But if we say that, no, the mitzvah is not really uprooted, the mitzvah is there, but the rabbis are telling you to ignore the mitzvah, so then it's all about behavior. And it's all about behavior because the working theory then is, I still have these two active forces coming at me. I still have the Torah saying blow shofar and the rabbi saying don't blow shofar. So the safest approach is keep your head down. Stay out of it. Everyone follow? A little complicated, but it's quite elegant. So just to recap, right, basically has these three questions. Is the Torah actually being rewritten? Or no, that's impossible, it's just being contradicted and you're supposed to listen to the contradiction. And if the Torah is still commanding you to blow shofar, and the rabbis are telling you not to, then we understand the Shev al-Tasa thing, it's about keep your head down because you have an active conflict. And then it's all about behavior. While if the idea is the mitzvah is completely uprooted, then Shev al-Tasa doesn't mean stay out of the conflict, there is no conflict. There's no longer any issue because the Torah no longer requires you to blow shofar on Shabbos. So then, Shev al-Tasa is coming from a different angle. It's coming just to limit the power of what's happening here because it's pretty radical. You're actually rewriting the Torah. That's something which is pretty extreme, so there's a limit to how far it can go. Okay, everyone follow? Happy to say it as many times as necessary, but does that make sense? It's a fascinating setup there. So all of this brings us back to the primary out of those three questions. There's one that we're really interested in, the one that's affecting our sugya. The question of, so what is it? Is the Torah really being rewritten here? Is that possible? Or is it something else? Is there an ongoing struggle, the Torah still commands one thing, and the rabbis still tell us to do something else, and how does that play out? And that's something which we will explore in much greater depth, God willing, tomorrow. Okay, again, any further questions? Any other issues? Okay, so we will stop here. It's pretty over time. Who wants to daven mincha for us? Have you set up first? Want to daven mincha? Okay. Bad luck, anyone? Jebediah?
Sure.
All right, Asher, Shabbat Shalom.